to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. My name is Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pejamon. Today, I am here with author William Galaney, who writes sci-fi and writes for games, and we'll mm-hmm. talk about that. Now, William, since we were having an interesting conversation, do you mind if we
pick up where we were?
Absolutely. So, you asked if I do audiobooks, and I don't yet, and listeners to the podcast will probably, they'll have heard this before, perhaps, but I do have plans. I'm hoping to have book one out on audio this year. And I tried to hire Michael Kramer and Kate Redding, and they declined. They said that they felt my book would benefit from a younger voice, and their voices carry a certain weight.
I get that. Yeah. But what was the alternative they offered to you?
They suggested their son and his recording partner. And I have not yet fully interviewed them. Mm. AKA, I got an audiobook recorded by, I don't remember their son's name, but younger Kramer. I started listening to it, but only a few minutes. I just haven't had time.
The audiobook aspect was something I've had the absolute joy of being involved in twice prior. And what I found was a lot of it hinges on not necessarily the atmosphere of the book, but on the character's mentality. So your protagonist is a young woman.
Yes.
So that could maybe her mentality, her approach to topics, her perhaps naivety or perhaps idealism could shade the person you choose. Mm-hmm. This book here was my second novel, and it is about...
For anybody listening on audio, we're talking about The Line.
Oh, so I'm so sorry. Yes, The Line. My second book came out in 2012. But that is a book about time-traveling historians who figure out one of their future selves is altering the line, so they all turn on each other. Mm. And the main character, who is very much the protagonist, but is also a sort of disassociative, very functional sociopath. Because that's just how she's successful. She's made that work. So I tried to find someone who had a crisp, bright, professional voice with an undercurrent of hostility, or at least detachment. And I found the perfect narrator, Alison Voller, who actually had done a lot of comedy before that, because she always plays the distraught mother or the barely holding it together woman at some event, and she was great.
I gotta say, two really interesting concepts in the premise of the book. So you have different versions of the same person teaming up against the one. So it's kind of like the Flash, right?
I saw The Flash. You know, everyone said the movie was so bad, but
I haven't seen the movie.
Oh, I enjoyed it.
I'm referring
to Flashpoint, the comic.
No, not even that. Although I saw the animated Flashpoint Paradox.
Oh, wait.
But
CW? All right.
Oh. But no, the show with I don't remember any of the actors' names, but the one that started, I don't know, eight
it was CW, I think. So they're all young and good looking, like they're from Dawson's Creek. Yeah, the show was bad. It's funny how DC is really good on TV. But not to give too much away, but all these
histories. Oh, that's different universes.
This is all the same line. Okay. So I don't necessarily do a multiverse thing as much. And when I wrote this book, the idea or the very phrase multiverse hadn't entered the public zeitgeist because Marvel hadn't gotten there yet. Uh-huh. So what I was in some ways pulling from was that these historians figure out one of their future selves is the problem. And so they all turn on each other. And of course, the last individual standing now needs to understand that, number one, it was them the whole time. Number two, why? And then we go through the journey and we get the same narration again from the future self's perspective. The idea was I wanted to write where, as a character, being afraid of who I would become as an adult, like I was hitting 30, and I'm like, oh no, I better start shaping this up pretty quick. I wondered if my future self would find my past self an antagonizing presence. So I tried to actually write that to where their enemy is one of their future selves, and try to avoid paradoxes and time causality loops that way.
Yeah. And the other thing that really caught my attention was You said a psychopath protagonist?
Mm-hmm.
That's not commonly done.
No, and she's not a murderer. She's not a killer. She doesn't daydream of whatever. She's just emotionally and mentally detached on the clinical level of sociopathy.
Sociopath, not psychopath.
Yeah, sorry, sociopath. Yeah, so she's...
I think I misspoke it.
I might have also, much to my failure. No, but she is a historian, and in some ways her... Even growing up as a young woman, her inability to directly connect with people on an individual scale pushed her into the sciences of tracking history and sociology, trying to understand people on a larger scale. She's trying to answer the question of what is people? Mm-hmm. And so that was why she became an expert in her field as a historian. And I have tremendous affection for her because we all struggle to try and bridge that gap.
Uh-huh.
And with her, it was very difficult because I was just turning 30. She was in her mid-40s, and she's much smarter than I ever will be. And those are two things that I'm not. So trying to write someone you're not was difficult. So I'm not necessarily sociopathic, but I can empathize enough to try and imagine it.
Yeah, I get what you mean, like trying to figure out what are people like. What I definitely feel like my brain works differently from a lot of other people much of the time.
Not a bad thing.
So I'm looking around to see what other people are doing, to see what cues they caught that I didn't.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, absolutely. And
got me through boot camp.
Yeah, I bet it did.
When in doubt, look about. Like, well, and also just sometimes the drill instructors are the far end of the squad bay and they say something you don't hear, it didn't come through clear.
So watch everyone else.
Okay, that's what they're doing, that's what I'm doing.
Right. The thing for me is, it's funny you say boot camp, like with basic,
So you were Army?
I was Army, yeah. So I was almost a soldier, whereas you were a rifleman. But I was Army, and the experience I had was, especially in basic, you mentioned boot, but basically mm-hmm. it was just Boy Scouts with explosives. I had so much fun. And like everyone next to me just... Oh, these grown men, twice my size, better shape, tougher people, much tougher people because I'm a wuss, were crying. And I'm like, what's wrong? It's like, well, they're so mean. Drill sergeants yelling at us. I'm like, they're not hurting you. Because I grew up with a not exactly an emotionally safe environment at home. So when I got to basic, no one was against me. They're all on my side despite being yelling and obnoxious and, you know, mm-hmm. making me do push-ups until I, you know, vomited. I'm like, no one's out to really hurt me. So I loved it. I had a blast.
Well, good. My experience was interesting. So I went to boot camp. I was 27.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I was 25.
I was your typical 18-year-old recruit. And so, like, they have pooly activities while you're getting ready to go to boot camp. Mm-hmm. They have, like, weekly or monthly activities where they come together and do some physical training and learn some stuff. And I was already married. I had taught a year of school. And well, at this point, when I was a poolee, I was working two jobs and I had a newborn baby. So like one of the, this major or captain from the recruiting station called me at, I guess he wanted to confirm what his Marine had taught him.
Yeah.
Like, why aren't you coming to the poolee activities? Well, I'm married. I have a newborn baby. I'm working two jobs. Like, I have nothing against coming, but man, I'm busy.
Yeah, what part of me do you want me to show up? I can give you a foot, maybe.
So I was maybe a little less acculturated when I went to boot camp.
Which is not a bad thing.
I was game to go and work hard, and I had learned some things, I'd heard some things, and then I was just kind of surprised at how seriously everyone was taking everything. Like, during our in-processing week, when... there was a moment when it was just the recruits milling about. We're waiting for the drill instructors to come back and tell us to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like leaning against the bunk bed and, you know, talking to the other recruits and like, you shouldn't cross your arms. Like, why not? Because it means like you think you're in charge. I'm like, well, I don't. Like, yeah, but if the drill instructor sees you, well, there's no drill instructors here right now.
Yeah, we're people.
So everybody was taking everything so seriously. And I'm like, okay, fine. You know, if the other recruits think I shouldn't and should be cautious, I guess I can be, that's fine. And then I saw the drill instructors, like, when we really got into the cycle, how seriously they took themselves, at least in front of us.
Or in front of you, yeah. Yeah, I remember that.
And when you first meet your drill instructor team, they call it Black Friday because you're supposed to be scared and intimidated. Okay, yeah.
We call it Day Zero and Shark Attack or something like that.
Yeah. So the drill instructors are running around the squad bay yelling at random recruits for random things. And I'm at one end, you know, I'm just like a few beds in mm-hmm. from one end. So I'm kind of looking over and watching the chaos and I'm entertained by it. Like, that's pretty funny. You know, now he has to scream this thing just because they said so. And then it got harder when they started. So they give you incentive training. They make you do exercises, right?
Oh, yeah. Is that what they call that? Because we call it smoking.
Incentive training was the official term. Because if you don't do the right thing, then they'll make you physically train. And that's your incentive to do the right thing next time. Well, I got miffed or kind of put off a little bit because they'll get you and make you do mm-hmm. IT even if you're doing the right thing. Like, totally doing the right thing. Like, excuse me?
It's just going to happen one way or the other. So just sort of a c'est la vie attitude.
Yeah. And at one point, weeks later, our drill instructor tells us to do something and we all say, aye, aye, sir, you know. And me included, I did exactly that. And you shout it. And I shouted it. Some random drill instructor had nothing to do with us, was walking by, and he turns and shouts, "You respond," right in my ear. Like, it hurt for a couple of days. And I'm, you hear that, VA?
Got
some damage in my left ear. And, well, that's, you know, this gets, anyway.
That's why the drill sergeant yelled at you, because like, he couldn't hear anything either.
I honestly resent that. Like, that should not be.
Yeah, you're being.
The chaos and the training, legit. You need to learn how to face the chaos. You need mm-hmm. to learn how to think and act in the face of chaos and disorder and confusion. But I resent that, like, that screaming in my ear was, in a word, mistreatment. Now we're way left field, off topic.
Yeah, it's a very defining experience because you're completely saturated every single second of every single day. And it's surprising because when I think of it, and I think of like a horse, which is what, like 12 to 1800 pounds of meat and muscle and teeth and, you know, hair, you can break in a horse within a week. And that is more spirited than I am. So a part of me was afraid during basic, like, did I join a cult that's going to, you know, am I going to wind up just being one of, because you always see those people who just, they have made their personality the most shallow level of that culture.
Uh-huh. And drink all the Kool-Aid and that's that.
Right. And I was scared of that. But luckily, I kept constantly encountering, possibly out of luck, a lot of officers and NCOs and cadre who were very much of the thought process that you've got to be a person first, soldier second. Mm-hmm. Because what good of a soldier are you if you're not a person? And it was a very conscientious experience I had in the Army in the early 2000s. And it makes me wonder that when I encounter other veterans and I hear about their experiences, how radically different in that, like, when I compare notes to my time at Benning or Leonard Wood or Sam Houston, then I get other people talking about Bragg or other years, and it's just a completely different experience. So it does not seem nearly as homogenous, at least in the Army, as the Marines present themselves to being. But like mm-hmm. you said yourself, you went and married at 27, which does make me ask the question, and I'm not trying to be wry, but what led to that? Because I had a literature degree, so I had no future. I had to go in the Army. So what about you?
Well, I mean, military service was always an option, but it wasn't something that really called me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, unless, like, if there were World War III and we really needed people to go and fight, I would be there, like, no question. And I considered it after 9/11.
Right.
Although I had specific plans in my life for those next couple of years. And, like, I was going to serve a mission and teach about Jesus Christ for a couple of years, mm-hmm. and I was going to go and get my degree. Mm-hmm. And as I considered like military service from time to time, it just wasn't in the forefront for me, and it seemed like there were enough people, so I wasn't really needed. And that was my perception at the time.
So you say mission Mormon? Or okay, got it.
Yeah.
That explains the lovely attire, the self-respecting haircut. So you can tell Mormon. He eats well.
All right. Time back in.
Yeah, we spliced back in. We had visitors. Keep going. You were saying that you were going to do mission and then...
Yeah, so I did my mission, and that's how I learned to speak Spanish. And then I continued and got my degree in music education, because I wanted to teach band. And I did that.
Not a growth industry.
I taught band. And, yeah. And it was... I got a job in a small town in Kansas.
Okay.
And I was the band teacher in town, 5 through 12th grade.
Oh, that's a Hallmark movie right there. Yeah.
Except, well...
You don't get snowed in, though.
I was just... there was snow.
Oh, really?
There was snow, yeah.
Oh, Kansas.
It wasn't particularly deep.
Kansas City also has a very rich music
history. We might have had a couple of snow days. I'm not sure. But, the snow wasn't particularly deep, but it snowed sideways. I'm pretty sure it actually fell in Colorado and blew east.
All the way, yeah.
I was kind of alone as a band teacher in the town, right? Mm. And other towns weren't that far away, but as far as like if I'm going to touch base with other band teachers, then one of us is taking time out of a day, except we need to be teaching during that day. And there were like mentor teachers, but the mentor system, it's generic. It's not geared for music teachers. And so I had a lot of frustrations. Then there's the fact that my brain's a little different. Mm-hmm. And frankly, sometimes I'm scared of people. Not that they're going to do something to me physically, but I care about their reactions. I care about what people think.
They're socially erratic.
Yeah. And with a computer, it's very easy. If I misstep, I'll like go back.
You know,
do
it's your fault.
The wrong way. Go back, do it the right way. The wrong thing never happened, and we carry on. But people aren't like that. People are offendable, and I was nervous to do so.
Man, if you offend me, you get a gold star. I will congratulate you.
Well, I'm a little bit less about a little bit less nervous about offending people these days.
I'm good. Yeah.
So it was a very stressful year, and I was going to stay on anyway. But
teaching a school and managing a classroom is not easy, especially if you fall underneath any type of neurodivergent umbrella, especially with all the stimuli, and then the parents. Some of which occasionally choose to be recreationally offended by something, mm-hmm. or if you're the band teacher, anyone who likes music thinks they can help. You know, so I do not envy you that position.
Well, and I think the parents in this district were pretty good.
Good.
However, it was difficult for me to feel understood by my administration. And maybe they did understand, but I didn't feel it.
I didn't feel like
we had good communication.
So were they not like tending to your needs or not acknowledging the fact that your department requires an enormous amount of space in the building?
I had my space, but I also had daydreams. Like I wanted to build the program back up because mm-hmm. when the old teacher left, the program shrank. So like I said, I was 5 through 12. And so there was a 5th grade band, there was a 6th grade band, there was a middle school band and a high school band. 5th and 6th grade were each about 30 kids. Middle school was 27 and high school was 13.
And so this is band, so no strings?
No strings.
Okay.
High school was 13 kids because from what somebody else guessed was mm-hmm. the cause, the previous teacher was intimidating, and so some kids didn't want to quit because he would still be around, and maybe they'd feel like he thought they were disappointing them.
They saw whiplash.
Anyway, so yeah, when he left, a lot of kids quit, and I had 13. Anyway, so I was going to stick around, try to build the program. I tried talking to the administration about the potential of doing a marching band in the future. They had at some point in the past. There were still uniforms in the attic. And I talked to the principal about the potential. I didn't talk much. I mentioned it. And I wonder if maybe this is something that could have been a breaking point between us. Because I left when I knew that they didn't want me either. I had talked to them about maybe getting the room outfitted sonically or acoustically.
Right.
Because it was horrible.
Like, you can't practice in a room without proper...
It was a rectangle with no...
It had no buffering?
No buffering. So it was...
So just a black box.
Yeah, really loud, really echoey.
Oh,
and
means everyone goes sharp.
Well, and it's too loud. It's just too loud. And, like, if I were an administrator and didn't care, and the band teacher is thinking of having a reputable company come and recommend some acoustic baffling, that's going to be expensive. Let's get rid of the band teacher before that happens. Before he proves that we have to
no
do that.
No fundraiser, no concert, no talking to the PTA, none of that.
So we had concerts. We didn't need funds because we didn't really do... A little bit. There was a little bit. But on that front, we kind of had what we needed because our needs were small. Anyway, so going way back, it's time out again.
Yeah.
Time back in.
All right.
And that's an interesting point that you just said about you kind of interviewing me.
Yeah, I've seen your interview. That's funny. Reversals.
And I did that today. My episode that released today was that. But that was actually on purpose. So anyway, I'm like, well, it's not working very well at this school I'm not comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked around. I was in a small town, and with very few exceptions and not seeing those openings nearby, getting another band teaching job meant moving.
And you didn't want to move.
We bought our house there. And so teaching band was not going to pay enough
for us to
move again.
I just want to point out that he's heading in the story to tell us about how he joined the Marines. And he just said he didn't want to move.
No. I couldn't afford to move.
Ah, so now the Coast Guard is going to move him. Okay.
No, so we bought our house. And another teaching job might give us like $1,000 to move, and
yeah,
that wasn't going to cover it.
I would never see that.
Yeah, so I called a Marine recruiter, because a PFC, when you consider the fact that I was married, so there's BAH, and there's a housing allowance, a private first class makes more than I was making as a band teacher with a degree.
It's about right.
Time out. Time in. Is that three times now?
That's fine. I'm fine with it if you are.
It's just, it makes more work on the editing side. And
honestly, to some extent, so long as you're okay with protecting your child's face, which is completely understandable, I don't mind it. I think more interviews should be interrupted with reality.
Yeah, I don't mind him. I don't mind showing his face, but like trying to produce the podcast. It's so much more work to have these interruptions. So anyway, I called a recruiter and went in the Marines.
So not Air Force, because you didn't want to golf or ride a bicycle or be good looking. Not Navy, because you want a job afterwards. And not Coast Guard, because you, didn't want to fly into a hurricane when everyone else is flying out. So you chose Marines.
I chose Marines. And there were two big reasons behind that. Mm-hmm. And one is because if there were some big national emergency and they need people to go and fight, I wanted to be ready for that.
Okay.
And the Marines really push that in their advertising.
Oh, and the Crucible does.
Every Marine or rifleman.
And you get SEERS training and all that. Yeah, okay. What's the other reason?
The other reason is if I go back to teaching band, Marines look good on the resume because there's reputation for Marine bands.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Hmm. And there's also, just very practically, most of the services don't have as many bands as the Marines. Or maybe all of them don't. Maybe Marines have more. I don't know how many bands the other.
When I think Marines, I think tuba. Yeah.
Tuba.
Oh, yeah. Ha, ha, ha.
Anyway, so as far as like practicality, if I were going Air Force musician, there are many fewer positions.
Oh, so you're
hard to get into. Actually, Army has more bands.
Oh, don't go Army.
But they're guard bands.
Oh,
they're part-time jobs.
All right.
And so that wasn't going to meet the
bill. It wasn't going to meet the, unless you get deployed because National Guard or Reserve being deployed had very high friendly fire fatality rates. So you don't do that. And for a note for those at home, the reason why Army isn't something you picked, because Army is the Denny's of military branches. No one goes out to join the Army. You just kind of end up there. Okay? So that's why, kids.
You got the good military jokes.
I was in it, so yeah. I lived it. So how many years have you been in?
Well, I mean, that's a little more complicated. Now I'm in the reserves.
Okay.
So I did almost 12 years on active duty.
Okay. Okay, so, and you got the benefits then, the Jim Montgomery bill, because you already had your degree, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would pass down to your kids?
I could. I tried to transfer a few years ago, but there was a regulation detail.
They changed the laws.
They turned it down, and I could do it now, but that means I have to commit to 4 more years, and right now I'm not certain that's going to happen. I might use it myself. I might go and get another degree.
Gather up degrees like Pokemon, maybe one will, Well, I mean, so how many kids do you have?
3.
8? Oh, that's right. Okay, so you're only just starting. So you don't want to go in for another 4 years. You got to Mormon it all the way into the sunset. I mean, you've got a van, right?
We don't have a van. Oh. We have something that looks like a tiny van.
Oh, that little Scion. Yeah, it's a lunchbox. It's a lunchbox.
The lunchbox, the bread micro truck.
Yeah.
And we have an SUV.
Awesome. I have always wanted... Okay, so I keep hitting the thing. Yeah. I apologize for the sound issue.
It's a portable table. It folds up and he's hitting the handle.
Yeah, and I got this big gut. I don't know what to do with myself. But I've always found that particularly Mormons are woefully underrepresented in science fiction.
Really?
And I find that...
That's interesting. I was actually talking to my wife the other day about how I have observed that there's... more authors who are, but non-science fiction, I guess.
Well, science fiction, immediately you think of Orson Scott Card and him being Mormon. But in the end, none of his books really represent Mormonism whatsoever. What I mean by represented is not necessarily the authors themselves or the people who produce the material, because there's plenty of them, but a lot of them necessarily write about Mormons in science fiction settings, unless we go to like The Expanse, in which case Mormons are low-level antagonists. Are low level throughout the
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. They're basically a butt of a joke and dismissed. And then, like, the only time I've seen Mormons in my limited experience through narratives in a very positive light is in the Fallout games, and hopefully soon the TV show, Mormons converted to basically the most successful ethically stand-up faction in the Midwest after the United States collapses.
In the what games?
No, in Fallout.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so in that setting, they wound up becoming, very reliable.
I'm not versed in Fallout either.
See, nerd.
I've seen memes, but I haven't consumed that.
Played the game since day one, man. Those Fallout 2 nearly cost me college because it hit right during exams. So I've always wanted to really get, that type of representation, partly because Mormonism is just this purely American type of Christianity, even though it's all over the world. But it's fascinating in how it started and how they've revised their history, but also in a lot of ways how they are now steering back to acknowledging it. And all of it is positive. I myself am an atheist, so I don't have a horse in any of the races, but my wife is a devout Christian. She's Presbyterian. And it's just such an important part of humanity. So whereas you are trying to look around and see what other people are doing in many behavioral facets, I'm doing that specifically with faith. Because whatever bone you need to believe in Santa Claus or Christ or anything, mm-hmm. I was born without. Like even as a kid, like nothing. And it's not like, you know, I was raised Catholic and people are like, oh, that's why you're an atheist. You hated Catholicism. Like, no, it's just not there. There's no animosity. I just never had it. So I'm always watching other people and how they worship and their faith and how it improves their lives and how it connects or how it undermines them sometimes. And it's just very interesting to me.
It's an interesting point of view.
And then faith always comes up in my books because it's such an absolute vital part of humanity. No culture has ever, no population has ever.
Kind of leaning out.
Oh, am I in your space?
No, I just.
I try not to spread organ. You don't want the Marines to attack the army. But although proportionally size wise, I think we're about right. and that was one of the things that came up in the line was herd attachment. Whereas I am not a sociopath, at least as far as I know. My main character, Mary, was, and I played up on my detachment of faith, but I blossomed it up to being her detachment of interpersonal relationships on almost a casual basis. And what my character found out eventually was that she could form very deep, meaningful, loving relationships. She just couldn't get through the mire before that of all the small talk and the tiny reciprocities required to establish those relationships. Mm-hmm. So when a traumatic event occurs and she gets through it with someone, they're now in a deeply loving, kind, and caring friendship, and she doesn't know how she got there. So she doesn't understand the roadmap of relationships as a sociopath, but she can have feelings. So that's why I said light sociopathy, maybe not even necessarily.
Yeah, and I can hear that. Like, you don't, in getting through the protocols, the social protocols to get there. I learned how to ask a girl out on a date, you know, during this one period. So I had this one relationship and that ended, and I had another relationship and that ended. And then for a while I was kind of drifting, and I had lots of first dates.
Mm-hmm.
With girls that I liked, mm-hmm. but I did not see clear signals that they were interested, and maybe they were, maybe they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
I know one that I could tell was not interested, but it was mutual.
The restraining order was a giveaway.
We could both feel like this is anyway. No, we were just we had very different points of view on some important things, and that was that. We went our ways. Lots of first dates.
It's good you find that out on the first date.
Maybe some of them would have liked to see me again, and no. I don't know.
I am friends with most of the girls I've dated. In fact, my wife is mutual friends with a lot of them. I get along really well with a bunch of them. So, I mean, if I'm going to date someone in the first place, they have to be good just to ask them out at that juncture.
Mm-hmm.
But I do not envy, for all you kids in the audience, we do not envy you dating now, because we don't even know what this landscape looks like. Because I don't know how much older than I am than you, but because I swear I better be older than you. Because if you look that good at my age, this interview's over. But we used to just be like, hey, you want to go out? No? Okay. That was my method. That was me. Like you said, I learned how to ask a girl out. To me, it was no learning. It's just like, hey, you want to go out for coffee? Never go out to dinner on your first date. Just want to go out for coffee. Okay, fine. You sit and talk. And it was just such an easy thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was just social. It was just, yeah. So it was never rocket surgery, that aspect.
I got to give props to the BYU School of Music, by the way. So, like, if you're there as a music major, they want you to learn. Uh-huh. And they also want all the concerts to be supported. Mm-hmm. And so, like, every semester, I could get 6 free tickets to concerts throughout the semester within the School of Music, right?
Right, right.
And, all right, so where am I going to take this girl?
Right.
Let's go to a concert.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. It was great.
And sometimes it's good just to share the air with someone while you both enjoy something to see each other's reactions.
Oh, my goodness. Are you much of a consumer of classical music?
Yes, but again, casual. I'm not going to pretend like I can recognize Bela Bartok from Handel or something.
I got to see the Utah Symphony and Chorus perform Peer Gynt.
Yeah, I know Peer Gynt.
Peer Gynt, for anybody not versed, is the source. It's an oratorio. It's like... Okay, so you know what a theatrical play is, right? And then you know what an opera is, a play where they sing everything. An oratorio is an opera without the acting. So there's some narration, but everything is sung, but it's not acted. So Peer Gynt is an oratorio, and it's the source of the tune In the Hall of the Mountain King. Bom, 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 bom.
2 minutes, 40 seconds.
And there's another song that I'm going to sound really bad if I whistle, but... I guess I'll sing it. Anyway, it was fantastic. Yeah. I got to see Peer Gynt live and for free. And it was amazing. And In the Hall of the Mountain King is kind of intense.
It's awesome.
Like, it's intense. And it wasn't in English, but they had the words that they were singing. Projected in English overhead, so you could see what they were singing while it's going on. And like at the climax of that song, it's da da da. It's all the mountain sprites or whatever saying "kill him, kill him." Like, man. Anyway, so yeah, I got to see it for free. It was great.
And
I had a date.
Time signature on that is insane, and it's seeing it live. You know, and what, you know, like, so you're on a date, you get to see how she reacts, you know, she jumps out of her seat, because that's, at the end of that piece, is a punch. And for me, one of the best live experiences was Holst's The Planets, because when Mars rolls out, because if you go back and listen to The Planets, Holst's work, and you listen to Mars, you're going to be like, okay, I've heard that in every Hans Zimmer movie soundtrack, because it just became the prototype for that type of intensity.
We've talked about
everything but horse.
Everything except. I had a question. No, I had a comment. So if you want to see more LDS or Latter-day Saint representation in science fiction, then buy my fantasy so that I can afford to keep writing. Because I have plans. I have specific plans for a sci-fi series in mind.
And so that's why, don't do it through fantasy. I want to see it in sci-fi because I want them called Mormons. I'm tired of people wanting to express it.
Oh, so you're talking about characters.
Yeah.
I just meant authors.
Oh, yeah, no. Authors, there are a number of fantastic authors.
I haven't decided. I have no specific plans to identify a character as...
Yeah, I do. Like, I plan on having Mormons in space. You know, I want that representation.
Did you see...
I want to see how that culture translates over Jews in space with
History of the World Part 2. Is it Part 2?
Part 2 came out, but at the end of Part 1, like 25 years ago, was a trailer for Part 2.
I thought there was
trailer. That was Jews in space.
Okay.
And they're flying around. Yeah.
So Part 2 did come out?
Part 2 eventually did come out. It wasn't that great. And part of the issue is Mel Brooks' stuff is always great, you know, when you tell it to friends, but his timing for his jokes don't land a lot.
I saw it in pieces on TV when I was about 10.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I didn't have any context or anything, but there's just this weird stuff going on, and the Jews are in space during the credits.
Viking funeral. See, Hitler arrives. I used to work in a video store, so it was a place where you went to go rent out movies on the weekend. And, we could not keep Mel Brooks in stock. Everyone came in and kicked down the door every Halloween we needed to buy extra copies of Young Frankenstein.
I think with Mormons, with members of the church I belong to, there is, I guess I'm only speaking for myself, but I imagine how other authors might be thinking. There is a natural desire to make characters to be of the same faith. Mm. And because, frankly, we're very misunderstood. And I grew up in the Bible Belt. In Dallas, Texas. And I had kids in high school. I had kids come up to my table at lunch to Bible bash me and tell me about how their pastors told them that we had horns. I'm like, I'm not off, finding it.
That would be metal. Okay. If you had horns, it's awesome.
Anyway, so there's definitely a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah.
And just a lot of confusion. And so like there is an inherent desire to like, well, and to put myself on the page I do that with Nightshade Unicorn. Obviously the main character isn't male like I am. Mm-hmm. I'm a man. My main character is a young woman.
You're oldest.
But there are attributes that I definitely identify with.
We have to, because, and this is common knowledge, anyone who writes, no character can attain the escape velocity of the writer. So what we have to do is, through discipline and skill sets, try and hide as much of that as possible and add in what you had noticed, your observations from when you're in the bay or when I'm wherever, yeah, to put into the character to make sure it doesn't seem like it's us.
So there's a natural desire to put the anonymous version of oneself out there to be known, to be seen. And I think we see this where people are kind of doing that on Twitter or X these days. There are accounts where people are just out there. Well, that's very different from a novel.
Yeah.
Now, the tempering of that desire, mm-hmm, because if I go and I do that, I feel like it'll probably be received like, I don't know, like what's the word I'm looking for a sweet romance is just the most, if picture kind of macho men audience, mm, sat in front of the most chick flick. All right. So I kind of have this perception, and maybe it's wrong, that if I were to write this, all these characters, all these Mormon characters, just because I have this urge to put this part of myself out there, excuse me, I feel like that would probably be received as well as this chick flick in front of that audience. And so there's a tempering of that urge.
I get
and
that.
I think that's why, it's so like in Ender's Game, mm, Orson Scott Card did it in a tempered way. Ender's mother was raised in the church and then kind of drifted out.
Them being told they could only have one child also was not particularly a Mormon thing. But I agree, but I don't know. I'm at war with the logic of what you're presenting.
Okay.
Versus my idealism of example. A lot of people enjoy The Matrix for reasons I never understood. Because I enjoyed the movie, I'm like, whoa, bruh, you know, whatever, when it hit in theaters. But a lot of my friends, and include one of them I helped transition, are trans. And for them, The Matrix was a hallmark moment in culture where everyone was enjoying this thing that was essentially a trans allegory. And when I look back at that, I'm like, well, how interesting would it have been if it just was trans? Why does it have to be an allegory? I still think audiences now can set themselves aside if they can't associate directly with how the character looks or their faith, but they'll still love the story. A well-written character and narrative will always pull through. Aliens, as example.
Well, how many months? Because I've actually seen The Matrix,
yeah,
and I don't see a trans allegory. I'm open.
Well,
I didn't pick up.
I didn't see it either until the two directors who made it pointed out a whole list of things that made it trans allegorical.
Well, and there's I think to the, sorry to keep stuttering.
I'm thinking,
and things aren't coming out. Pixar's Luca.
I have heard. Yeah.
Oh, you haven't seen it.
Sorry. But no, tell me that.
I have heard, and I did not pick up on this, but I overheard, or maybe I saw people talking online, that it's about being gay.
Oh.
And
okay.
I did not pick up on that. I can see that, because it's kind of about being different. And I just picked up on it being about being different. And
I see. So, well, when I, for me, it's like, well, I think audiences can easily handle a gay character, so I'm not sure about the proxy, but maybe they wanted to make it more open to be different on all kinds of different levels, and perhaps the gay community connected to it more. I don't know. But as a heteronormative dude, I'm just a regular vanilla guy. I'm going to miss a lot of these signals and analogies. So it makes me wonder if, as me, an audience member, it might be better if it's just out there. I'm like, oh, okay, this character's trans, now for their story. And then I'll just be able to enjoy it on its terms. Sometimes, like when you're saying about, you're writing about a character who has a lot of you in them, maybe just write about you at some point. Maybe make you just another character in the book, perhaps not the main character, because I get the strong vibe, presumption, that your daughter is a strong influence in this book.
Or write a memoir.
Yeah.
And literally write about
you. Yeah, literally write about you or something of that nature. I think that would be fine. It makes me sad that we get Sikh people or Mormon told through the proxy of analogy in science fiction. When can we not imagine a future where you're here too? Because I would like to see in Star Trek, like, oh, you know, here's our Mormon, you know, there's no chaplains on the Enterprise. So I always wanted to see what the Enterprise's basic faith needs of its population were. But again, atheist, but I still never saw that whenever I watched Next Generation. I only saw religion tackled when it got to DS9. And then it was this wonderful, complicated thing. And it was like, this is the part I've been missing. Because Next Generation and also the original series kept treating it as though religion wasn't there. And that made me sad.
Sometimes it was there.
Oh, really?
Yes, in the original series. I remember Adonis or something. It's an episode with Adonis. There was an episode where a powerful force on a planet had trapped the Enterprise, and they sent a team down and there was a powerful entity there,
mm-hmm.
and who claimed to be, I think, Adonis, like the Greek god, literal.
Oh, the same person. Yeah.
And
the actor who played him is.
In the end, they kill him.
Right.
They figure out his power was tied to this one building, and so they fired down on that building, destroyed him, and William Shatner delivered a line that was along the lines of we already have a god and one is enough.
Oh.
So in that case, they weren't tackling religion.
Right. There's actually just false religion, but it was just in the background.
It was there.
Got it.
And
but
now
it's strong monotheism. That means that there aren't Hindis on the Enterprise.
Hmm.
So yeah.
And I understand. I speculate, because I don't specifically know this, that perhaps that episode or similar things were probably written from a very different or with a very different goal or under a different light. And then network censors like, no, we have our audience to think of.
A bit, right.
And so now I was going to say, like, as far as like why make it allegorical, not thinking about the Matrix, I still don't see the trans allegory, but
yeah,
I think
a lot of it was the whole wake up to be the real you, etc.
But that's anyway, so I think the question of whether you make it an allegory like that, or if you literally make it about the specific issue that you have in mind, is a question of audience. Who are you trying to reach?
Yeah.
Because some people will be interested in one and not the other.
Which blows my mind.
And vice versa.
And that might speak to me more as a reader, in that I'll read anything.
Well, and so specifically with The Matrix, you have this literal waking up or coming out of a false world.
Just a great scene.
That is not specific to any real world circumstance.
Right.
And so it's generic.
So anyone could put their awakening into it, be it trans or otherwise. It need not be a specific allegory. No, you're absolutely right.
That's why I think it's a question of what audience you're trying to reach.
Well, I'm going off the directors themselves stating that it is such, but also there's a possibility that it might have been reverse adopted. Like J.K. Rowling, after all the audience kept speculating that Dumbledore was gay, she came out and said, oh yes, he's gay. So sometimes
it could have been like, you know what, good idea.
Yeah. Sure. Oh yeah, of course I meant to do that, because believe me, I've done that as a writer. Like, oh yes, I'm glad you caught that thing that I totally didn't do. But I would like to see a future where our current population is represented down the road accurately and not necessarily with an axe to grind from the person who's writing it. Because as much as I love The Expanse, I did find that their treatment of Mormonism wasn't fair. And again, this is not that I esteem necessarily one subset of Christianity above another, because I don't make fun of everybody equally. But it would have been nice to have a more holistic representation of an entire group of people who were faith-based. Because whereas going back to the Next Generation, then I'll stick with that instead of the original series. It was Next Gen was a very much a humanist show, which I am a humanist. But I also think that a part of being a humanist is acknowledging the absolute vitality that faith has in large populations. They can go hand in hand. They don't have to be separated. And I would like to see more science fiction with those two things conjoined. And that's why I really appreciate the occasion that we do get science fiction that has those things conjoined, like Signs, the M. Night Shyamalan film, I thought was a very good movie that merged science fiction with Christianity. In some ways, Interstellar did a little bit as well. What was the other one? Silent Running. The Stewardship of the World. It had some strong biblical themes. Did you ever see Silent Running?
No.
That might be the only one.
I think there's another aspect that is in play, and that's if you're not trying to put that thing out there with an axe to grind, as you say.
Right.
It's a question. It's a decision to be made. Are you going to do it with an axe to grind or not? And
how much
that will affect what direction you take with it. Now, with Nightshade Unicorn, I just have not made decisions about religion.
You only have one book. You may not have a lot of time.
Well, I did a little bit. I mean, I mentioned, so like there's an entity called the Shrongolin. And I don't get into, like, these are the teachings about this legendary figure of the Shrongolin. But I mention that, or maybe I have a character mention that, no, I think it's in the prose, not quoted by a character, but some people believe him to be the creator, and some people believe him to be something shy of the creator, but there have been there are different beliefs about this entity, but I haven't gotten into, like, there's this country over here and they believe this and they worship like this, and this country, I have not done that.
Well, it may not serve your story at that juncture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not significant in the story as far as like what they thought. It might be important later. I don't know yet. But if I were in a situation like this, and I'll tell you a little bit about the book, because the main character gets woken up in the middle of the night by a unicorn, and she is told that the world has a problem. There's this big bad evil. It's going to wake up and break free. And the unicorns need to stop this big bad evil, and they need her help. So now she has to go on this journey. And, well, this journey lasts more than 7 days. And so, like, if I were to really get into...
It doesn't have to be a one-to-one analogy.
No, but it... Like, these thoughts occurred to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I decided to pass it up, because that's not what this story is about.
Right. It's like, hard not to do that.
It's like, is there a day of worship? I haven't even said.
Yeah.
Like, I'm writing book two, and I don't know if they have a specific day of worship. I haven't had to decide that, and so I just haven't decided that. I've just kind of left it out. And maybe that's... maybe that's bad on me. Maybe I should put it out there.
No, I mean,
I don't want to do that with this
as
series.
Many barriers you can remove between the reader and the book, the better. So, like, it, you know, well, they're not going to call it a mile. They're going to call it a flarvin. No, don't do that. You know, just use nomenclature that's easily accessible to get to the point.
And do a little, like, I use leagues.
Yeah, everyone uses leagues. I use leagues in my... So, I did Steampunk Dante's Inferno as my bigger, my best-selling series. So, I use leagues. Because I'm like, well, I don't use miles because, you know, I don't want to use kilometers. So, all right, leagues it is. And then I wound up being like, is it nautical leagues or land that leagues? Mm-hmm. But no, it's, yeah. And I'm not trying to at all say you should have Mormons in your fantasy book. But it's, I feel that with least with fantasy, when it comes to faith, a lot of what faith comes up with in the real world or portends or points at is taken as being real and tangible in a fantasy setting. So you don't have to necessarily dig quite as deep for characters who have faith, whereas in the real world, faith itself as a concept requires absolutely no proof or oftentimes evidence to be a shining beacon of ethics or hope for individuals or entire populations, because faith by definition operates like that. So I just... And also, like I said, as far as Mormons or other populations, I would just like to see people in the future directly representing our population now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, where are the Mets fans going to be 300 years from now? Are they still Mets fans?
The Mets, huh?
Yeah, I picked the Mets.
I don't really watch sports.
I'm going on faith. So, if you're a Mets fan, there's no reason. You just feel it in your heart. And you love the Mets.
Well, you see, in 2067, when cricket became the national sport.
Oh, oh, it's because
you gotta know what a crumpet is to understand cricket. You know the quote?
No. What?
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the movie.
Raphael. Oh my gosh!
Cricket. Cricket.
Oh,
you gotta know what a crumpet is to understand cricket.
Casey Jones.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
Casey Jones.
And then he was in a movie called Prophecy Down the Road. Casey Jones. Why did you pick that name? Because Bishop is a great name.
My first name is Don. And I don't know. Don Bishop. Maybe I'm wrong, but to me that didn't sound like...
This name is impronounceable crap. So you could have handled Don Bishop just fine.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll use it for... another genre.
Oh, that's true.
I wanted some separation.
Well, you said in one of your interviews how authors really have to, like you mentioned multiple times, knowing your audience, which is right, which I'm terrible at because I write for a bunch of different genres, but also how presenting yourself as a product on the shelf, knowing where to sit your book is a big deal. One of the best books I've ever written starts off as a fantasy for the first six pages, and then they realize they're basically on the Truman Show.
Hmm.
And it's a showcase for which to display a game, a live action unscripted television show that's broadcast. And the season one villain breaks out into the city. And so all the characters break out into the
city. Like Moriarty on the Enterprise.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, perfect example. Moriarty on the Enterprise or the wonderfully bad Masters of the Universe movie. So just completely out of your setting. But every agent I sent this to, well, not every, of course not. But a number of them came back and said, this is fantastic. We will never touch this because we don't know what shelf it goes on. Because for part of its trick to work, it's got to present itself as a fantasy novel, but then it doesn't belong in that genre because it's really hard sci-fi once you get into it.
Well, I think that becomes a marketing question.
And that's all
not so much the shelving, but like
and that is
the blurb on the back. So, like, I have some surprises in this book, but, and I struggle with this myself. I have not tackled this, but some surprises you want to put on the back, and maybe I didn't.
It's hard to hint. The blurb is the hardest thing to write in anything.
Yeah, and so some surprises you want to give away.
Yeah.
Because it's I guess it works as a teaser. Like, here's one. There's more to come. Just stay along. But you also want it to hit right. And yeah. You want the reader to be surprised when they right. get there. So, yeah, like as far as the Nightshade Unicorn, at the beginning, I struggled to figure out and enunciate or articulate the difference between the character believing that unicorns are all female.
Oh.
And, of course, there is no Nightshade Unicorn. And the fact that the reader obviously knows, hello, it's right there on the cover.
Yeah.
Nightshade Unicorn.
That's tough.
So, like, give that away right up front.
Is the character imagining it? Is there some other negative, you know, like, malicious force at work, and yet it's on the cover? No, that is tough.
So, like, you know, for your, if the surprise is 6 pages in, then I might go ahead and give it away.
On the cover. And well, there was a big debate on this cover for this book, because I didn't want to show
the line.
Yeah, this is the thing moving through the timeline, altering the timeline, and then they realize it's one of their future selves, and I didn't want to show it. But my cover artist, we did one cover initially that was a bit more vague, and the book wasn't moving. And then this same cover artist who had done the other cover came to me and he's like, let me put Jaws on the poster for God's sakes. And that was his exact analogy. He's like, yeah, I get that you don't want to show the shark and you don't really show the shark in its entirety all the way throughout the book. He's like, but I got to put the teeth of the shark on the cover.
Yeah.
And then he did this one, and then now the book still consistently for the past few years sells.
Yeah, and with Nightshade Unicorn, there was a scene that I wanted to convey the import and the danger involved in this story.
Mm-hmm.
But for one, you probably don't want your book cover to be a literal illustration of a scene from the book. Sometimes maybe you do.
Yeah,
you want it to be more symbolic and attention grabbing and to communicate more the themes.
A conflict has to be presented.
And so, like, what we wound up, what Rebecca at Vivid Covers did, you have the Nightshade Unicorn, you have the main character there, and she's kind of like, what's going on here? She has a knife.
Lighting is a real winner for your cover.
Yeah.
Because the obscurity of the lighting leaves a lot of questions.
And then if you look at the back, and if you take the dust jacket, you can see it a little better. But you have this mountain scene.
Yeah.
And that's not where the book starts out.
Right. So and you know that they were going to be going there.
Like, the mountain location is late in the book.
Yeah, so...
very late in the book.
All four of my books do the same thing, where it's a wraparound setting that's later in, or midway in the book. Predominant main conflict usually is the setting I show. And I got very lucky with that artist for doing that.
Yeah.
That artist, by the way, look him up. His name is Alex Dolchkin, Dochkin. He has taken off. I could never afford him again.
Mm.
He does the Witcher TV show now, among other things.
Okay. Yeah.
So, Pedramon. Am I saying that right?
Well, I say it Pedramon, but it's Pedramon. Not like it's actually from anything.
Gotta catch him. Oh, Pedramon.
Yeah.
So, what's the TS stand for?
Not really anything specific. Kind of. So, the S is actually... it stands for a character from the Grindhill Chronicles, which has not been written. It's partially a little bit written.
All right.
And the T is, it sounds nice, TS. And I've decided which letters go in that name, but not in which order. So I don't even know what that full first name is yet.
It's reminiscent of CS, which is, of course, I think
that's
CS
true.
Lewis.
That occurred to me.
Yeah.
And it's also reminiscent of T.S. Eliot. Mm-hmm. And that's not on purpose, but, you know, I'll take it. It works. Yeah.
It's the name thing never occurred to me, and it might be an ego bit, but I'm like, if I'm going to die, I'm going to want my name on the books. And so,
I feel that.
So yeah, and I've published 7 novels, and there's other miscellaneous works and games and such, but it's all been my name. Speculative fiction would be the broad genre. If I tried to do romance, mm-hmm. it would collapse so hard. Because even if I was good at it, which romance is a very specific skill, it would be so far afield from my current genre that I would have no readership.
Mm. Yeah, and that's a balance that I'm going to have to tackle. My sci-fi series has a romance, has a love story that is very significant. But I'm not gonna be writing, like,
yeah.
First of all, I write clean. But I'm not going to... There's much more to the story than the love story.
And a closed-door romance will do just fine. I mean, I know they have cozy mysteries, but I suppose a cozy romance that's closed-door, as it were, can do great. The pull of, if you want a really good romance, Remains of the Day, give that a read. But that will... You need so little for romance to work so well based on skill. So yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about that. If the bones of it are there, then they're there.
It would be the balance of how much of the story is the love story and how much is the bigger events going on around it.
And how much I think the readership or the reader really wants these two characters to be together. One of my favorite, and I go off of movies a lot, Video Store and all that. My favorite romance movies was called Next Stop Wonderland, where the two characters don't meet, but it's a love story between them. And we see how their lives being different. They'll be so perfect for each other. So we're kind of like the babushka matchmakers are watching it. And at the very end of the film, they both sit on the metro together facing each other. And they're just about to talk and it's credits. And we're so happy and fulfilled that they finally get to meet because now they're going to hit it off and they're going to be happy. So yeah, if all the moving pieces are there.
And there's love story in Nightshade Unicorn as well. The beginning of one, rather. But that's going to continue.
Was it with the unicorn?
No.
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 Does she meet a donkey with a carrot taped to his head?
You guessed it.
Because that would be me, just as buck-toothed, hello, ladies. Yeah. That would be self-insertion in my book.
Oh, man. So I think we should probably kind of wrap up. We never got to the writing for games.
We don't know what the thesis is.
We'll have to do that another one. I'll have to figure out what the title for this episode is. But tell us a little bit about your books. You told us a little about The Line.
Okay, The Line.
And what else do you have?
So The Line is this one. And then I've got the first book I wrote right out of the Army. When a lot of folks were trying to push the narrative of America being a Christian theocracy. And so I wrote a book that's a series of rotating first-person perspectives a la As I Lay Dying, trying to illustrate how much it would hurt just regular people if America was a Christian theocracy. So here I do represent a number of folks. There's sadly not a Mormon character, but there is a Greek Orthodox character.
You're complaining, others. And then you did.
Yeah, I know, right? That's why I'm complaining. It's my guilt. So, but yeah, it's a short, and this is probably the one that I sell the most of, funny enough. And then there's these four.
You should write it again.
Write it again?
Add a
character?
No, not with a much larger... Well,
unabridged edition.
With a whole different paradigm. because the saints moved west to get out of religious persecution, mm-hmm. and for a relatively short time, decades, they were largely, not literally, but somewhat... I stopped myself because I haven't done my research and I'm going to say something wrong. But... like the Salt Lake Valley, Utah Valley, this area along the Wasatch Front was settled by the members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who came west, and they were all underneath this same religious leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Now they went and set up, like they became a state in the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though it was largely... of one faith in the region. It was not that there was literal separation of church and state.
Right.
But I didn't live there. I don't know how much in practice there was. But
there's a lot of religious homogeny.
Yes, that's what I'm looking for.
Right. But in the end, if I recall, and again, I haven't done up-to-date research either, but if I recall, it still followed the precepts and structures of typical county structure and voting.
Yes.
It's because they took the American forefathers seriously.
But I heard, and this is off topic, like the entire episode, but when, because these people came and voluntarily moved themselves across the country to live in this one place. So
to be away from it.
Obviously, there are a lot of these people of similar mind, of similar thinking, right? And so they're going to think along similar lines. But, like, well, we're democratic. And so now you have over there, let's just start off, you're voting Republican. You have voting Democratic, and then now we'll let it flow, but like just so we have.
So there's always representation.
Yeah.
And
I heard that. That's totally hearsay. I have not read up on
it. I've heard that too, but there's a lot of evidence to that being the case because, like, Harry Reid is Mormon. And, you know, so when Mitt Romney was running on the Republican ticket, I found any criticism against his Mormonism to be very disingenuous because there's just many Mormons on the Democratic side. So, and you know, a lot of people, seeing Utah as a red state, they make the presumption, and it's understandable, that since that's sort of the beating heart of American Mormonism, that clearly it's a red organization, but it's really not. So it's like saying, looking at Florida as a red state, man, have you been anywhere near the tip? Because that is all blue. So it's a complicated, nuanced thing.
Yeah.
But with this, what I did was I went for almost a generic evangelical and a Baptist theocracy. Because that seemed to be the loudest type of Christianity, because the Mormons were not calling for a Christian theocracy. So I basically wrote a speculative of the United States being your traditional Anabaptist, screeching Evangelian type society, and how it hurts everybody. Also wrote it because I was angry. I just came out of the army and I was pissed. Then I wrote Dante's Inferno, but I sped it to take place during World War I. And so the gates of hell are flooded because there's a big influx of customers. And it's about, the first book's about Ephestion breaking into hell to rescue Alexander the Great. The second one is about Boudica of the Iceni defending against a second Roman invasion trying to take over Dis, the Bohemian city on the lip of hell. So I took historical figures and wrote them in these settings. The research was exhaustive, but the best tool for research for me is the phone. I find people who are the experts on it, and I call them. That's just the best way to do it. And then they will tell you what reading to follow up on, but also they're always available. Then I've got a Bavarian Jew who's killed in the early 1800s, but this is about him trying to find his wife. She ended up in heaven. He didn't, so he's trying to locate her. And then this one is about his son, who's also Jewish, pretending to be a pope in order to survive in the afterlife. So he has to play up on a lot of those, of what he perceives a 15th century pope to be. So I had fun with that. And then this is Chromium Rise. I felt that there weren't enough people with autism presented in fantasy settings. Because so often, and this actually, I kind of blame J.K. Rowling on this one. Mm-hmm. Because I see the school, right? You know, welcome to Hogwarts and you're going to kill yourselves by accident. We'll laugh. There's no special education department at Hogwarts. Like, where's their cat B? What if you have Down syndrome, but you can still cast spells? I mean, you still have tremendous power. Would Hogwarts not accommodate? What about dyslexia? What about simple things like that nature? Emotional social disorders, etc. So I wrote a fantasy book within a bigger setting called Misplaced Mercenaries. They hired me on and said I could do what I wanted. So this guy doesn't have any magical powers. What it is that he's an alchemist, and he finds that it makes more sense dealing with chemicals and compounds and the scientific method in a setting where people are slinging spells, and to how he tries to save the day by utilizing his strengths in the setting, because I felt like autistic folks were not being represented in fantasy settings. I also kind of hate the Chosen One narrative. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, you're special. No, you're not. You're not special. But you'd still save the day. And that was kind of what I was trying to do with this. So this is a new series.
Yeah. I actually thought about that, and I kind of have the chosen one, but not.
Like, yeah, it's tough.
And it's to explained, like, it didn't have to be specifically you. It had to be somebody that fit the bill.
And you happen to.
You fit the bill.
Yeah.
And you're right here, so we need your help.
Listen. And have you seen the Lego movie?
Yes.
I love the deconstruction it does of the chosen one narrative. I told you you're the chosen one because you needed to believe it to get it done. Mm. And the fact, I mean, you have the proto hero quest, basically. A greater power shows up and gives the hero a quest, and you know, like you were saying. And I've done that too. And sometimes it's not even a matter of, it's a matter that the protagonist believes that they're the chosen one. And so we can play and subvert that somewhat.
Well, and I think Harry Potter does that too.
Yeah.
Like there was a dual chosen one. Like there was. It was Schrodinger's chosen one.
Oh, see, I wanted to. Who's the king?
They were both
sword?
The chosen one.
Yeah.
The box was open and Voldemort decided
who was
the chosen one.
Well, it's like the Highlander. There can only be several. It's like, did you ever see Highlander?
I saw part on TV.
Oh, it's
once.
Highlander is like.
I know the
park modern.
The idea with one kills another and gains his power.
And they always like, there could be only one. At the end of every movie, there's only one, but yet the next movie comes around, oh, there's a bunch more. Like, hey, well, okay, hold on. I got none of this. But yeah, and the other writing is mostly, like, this is for tabletop 5e D&D setting game system, but it's horror. There are a lot of minis that go with this, too. The minis are clearly the moneymaker that are through a company called Wicked. But I'm their head writer, so anything they produce, I get to write, which is a blast.
And that's what we thought we were going to talk about today.
Yeah, sorry.
The game writing. So
yeah,
another time.
Yeah, assuming you don't want to bring me back, and I'll, you know, by the time you bring me back, I'm going to have like a game on Mormonism. It'll just be a Oregon Trail.
The Salt Lake Trail.
Salt Lake Trail, yeah. Or like, you know, just I'm nah, well. Anyways.
Yeah, I wish I could leave this set up in place, but we're trying to sell this house, and yeah.
And anyone who's sold a house knows that they have to pull everything out and make it look like a serial killer's home before they can have someone else buy it.
Yeah. All right, well, I guess that's a wrap.
Yeah.
William Galaney, and where do people find you online?
Oh, WilliamGalaney.com. So my name, I'm sure that'll be in the notes somewhere.
Yep.
I'm super easy to find. You can just Google Galaney. The benefit of having a weird name is it can be found very quickly and easily.
That's another thing that
is that why you chose that? Because you're afraid of Bishop?
No.
I didn't think about that.
So honestly, it was because I didn't think Don Bishop sounded terribly much like an epic fantasy writer name. And also I wanted some separation and yeah, just kind of an identity separation.
In case you just took off and became so popular, you couldn't possibly fly or anything.
No, but yeah, I made it up, and coincidentally, it does exist letter by letter. That series of letters exists already. There's a mining company in Brazil called Pedramon.
You could have done
something
worse.
Like that.
You could have done worse.
But I found that out ahead of time, and I knew. I was like, well, that's fine.
Yeah.
They're over there in their corner.
There's no Pedramon Escort Service, so you're okay.
Yeah.
Well, see, like, with the line is the name of my second book. Yeah. That was a hard sell because, oh, yeah, the book's called The Line. Go look it up on Amazon. So then you notice that, like, now Withered Zion. Or, like, my title is convoluted.
Oh, yeah.
Trampling in the Land of Woe.
Yeah.
No one else wrote that title, so.
Yeah, there is something convenient about making something up. So if you Google Pedramon, you'll find me pretty quickly. Or just coming up with something distinct, like Nightshade Unicorn.
Or it'll
that's me.
Correct a
Pokemon. Google it, it's me. Or Pokemon. Yeah. Yeah. But Nightshade Unicorn won't autocorrect.
No, it won't. And I like Nightshade because the hints at the actual poison. Mm-hmm. And it creates an interesting kind of friction between the two terms, because when you think unicorn, I think, you know, peace, beauty, like the unicorns from the movie Legend, you know, or the last unicorn.
Legend.
Unicorns
Legend.
Are oh.
Oh, okay. I saw Legend.
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise.
So I always think unicorns in this positive, beautiful life.
And
when you get Nightshade, it kind of twists it.
Didn't, who played the
Tim Curry.
Tim Curry.
Yeah. I don't even know if he showed up with his own makeup or not. I mean, that guy ate that role.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
William Blaney, WilliamBlaney.com, and we'll catch you next time on the Grand Ole Chronicle podcast.
We're wasting more of your time in the future.